Please turn with me in your Bibles to the book of Judges, chapter 8. Judges, chapter 8. Reading by way of introduction, verses 4 and 5. Judges, chapter 8, verses 4 and 5. And Gideon came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him, faint, yet pursuing them. And he said unto the men of Succoth, Give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint, and I am pursuing after Zebah and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. And our subject this evening is Gideon perseveres. Gideon perseveres. Well, we continue in our studies through this book of Judges, and our attention at this present time is on Gideon, the fifth judge, the great judge. Just to recap briefly as to what has come to pass, well, Gideon has been raised up of the Lord to deliver the Israelites from the hand of the Midianites, who along with other tribes from the east have swarmed into the land of Canaan and have caused the Israelites to be oppressed. And many of them have sought refuge in high places, in mountains, in caves even. They cannot properly even inhabit the land of Canaan because of the Midianites. So they've cried to the Lord, and the Lord has raised up Gideon to be their deliverer, their judge, their latest judge. And last week we looked at the details of his initial battle with the Midianites, beginning with the assembling of his army, which was, of course, as you may recall, limited to 300 men by the Lord, to show that the Lord would get the victory, so that Israel could not say that they had gotten themselves the victory because of their sheer weight of numbers. No, the Lord would reduce the army down to 300 men so that when victory comes, they would know, they would be without any doubt that it was the Lord's victory. It was his strength that had saved them. And well, victory did come from the Lord, as we read. They went to the Midianite camp by night, and they shouted those words, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. Again, the Lord is leading them in this battle. And they had those pitchers with the lamps within them that shone a great light into the camp. The Midianites were in confusion, and they even began to turn on one another. And eventually they fled out of the camp, and the men of Israel, Gideon and his army, the 300, are in pursuit. And that really is where we got up to, verse 23 in chapter 7. And the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali and out of Asher and out of all Manasseh and pursued after the Midianites. So the camp has fled, the camp of Midianites has fled, and now there are many Israelites following after them, pursuing them. And Gideon, in verse 24, sent messengers throughout all Mount Ephraim, saying, Come down against the Midianites and take before them the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan. Then all the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together and took the waters unto Bethbara and Jordan. So Gideon is now calling upon other tribes to help mop up after the initial victory against the Midianites. Ephraim particularly has been instructed to seize the waters of Jordan, and they capture two princes. We read in verse 25, they took two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb. This is what the tribe of Ephraim does. And they slew Oreb upon the rock, they slew at the winepress of Zeb, and pursued Midian and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side, Jordan. So The tribe of Ephraim play a great part in the securing of the victory after the initial victory of Gideon and his 300. But in chapter 8, as we begin to look at this account that will take up our attention this evening, in chapter 8 we see that the men of Ephraim are not very happy. And the men of Ephraim, verse 1, said unto him, "Why hast thou served us thus, that thou callest us not when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites?" And they did chide with him sharply. They expressed anger. And why were they angry at Gideon? Well, they were angry because he had not called them to the initial battle at the Midianite camp at Harod, the battle that had been a great victory with the sword of the Lord and Gideon and the pitchers and the lamps. They weren't there. Ephraim had not been there. And so they were aggrieved. They felt that they had been left out. They felt that they had missed out on the glory. They wanted the glory of the victory, just like all the other Israelites did. They wanted to share in that glory. They wanted some of the credit. And Ephraim, by the way, considered themselves to be one of the most important of the 12 tribes. And so they're very angry. This great victory against the Midianites, we weren't there. You didn't call us. That's not fair. They're actually quite angry. There's considerable anger there. But this is, of course, not a good attitude expressed by the Ephraimites, by those of Ephraim. It was a very self-centered attitude. Instead of rejoicing in the great victory that the Israelites had had against the Midianites, they're making it all about them, all about the tribe of Ephraim. They're unhappy because they're not getting enough recognition. Why didn't you ask us? You've gone out and you've done something by yourself. Don't you know who we are? We're the tribe of Ephraim, the greatest tribe in Israel, in their own estimation, of course. We should have been there. And we weren't. And so we're not going to get any glory. We're not going to get any recognition. This was a very self-centered attitude, very sad. They should have been rejoicing with the Israelites, with Gideon. But it was all about them. And well, of course, the first application, a very easy application for us to make, is that this attitude is something that we need to avoid. A self-serving attitude, particularly in the church. These were fellow Israelites. These were Gideon's own kinsfolk, if you like. They were of the same nation. And yet, even within the nation, there were those who were, well, they were seeming to oppose Gideon and have a quarrel with Gideon. And it was all because of this self-serving attitude. And well, we must avoid that in the church. Yes, we are, of course, all important, every single one of us, but nobody is more important than anybody else. And we understand that. Ephraim, they were puffed up with a sense of self-importance. And really, this is, of course, pride. And pride, well, it leads to envy. They were envious of all those who had taken part in the battle. Why not us? Envy. That is such a sad attitude to see in a church. We don't have enough credit. We don't have enough recognition. And they're envious of those who do have. And so again, we examine ourselves. We apply it to ourselves. We must strive against pride, pride that causes envy. The church is not a competition between individuals. We're not trying to outdo one another. We're trying to serve the Lord. We shouldn't really be looking at what is this person doing? What is that person doing? How can I compete? How can I keep up in the pecking order? We should always look to the Lord. What does the Lord want me to do? Not looking around at other people, other individuals. What has the Lord set before me? What does the Lord want me to do? And give your all for him. Keep your eyes focused on him, not on what is this person, is that person getting more attention, or it's the Lord, always focused on the Lord. And so there is no place for envy. The tribe of Ephraim, they're envious. They want the same recognition as others. But this was an attitude that was harmful. Well, it only caused anger, in fact. That's what pride does. Pride causes envy. Pride causes anger. They did chide with him sharply. And that in the Hebrew is quite a strong word. Great anger, maybe harmful words, criticisms directed at him. And again, this is something we need to be mindful of. In my experience, there's nothing that provokes anger more than hurt pride. That is when people get angry the most. They will get irritated at certain other things. But those things that provoke the most anger within any single one of us, it's hurt pride. And that is very sad to see. Even in churches, again, we see it. So many fallouts, so many divisions and arguments. And the root cause is just pride, completely unnecessary, really. There was no need for Ephraim to fall out with Gideon at all. They're on the winning side. They're scoring a victory against the Midianites. There's no need for them to fall out. What's the reason? It's just their pride. That's the only reason. What a terrible reason. We weren't there. Why didn't you call us? That is such a sad reason. And so we have to beware of it ourselves. And if we are, well, we can avoid fallouts or any disagreements or anything of that kind. And Gideon, well, Gideon's example is very commendable in the face of this Midianite pride. If Gideon had been a proud person, he would have made the situation doubly worse. But he shows great humility here. And look at what he says, verse 2. And he said unto them, what have I done now in comparison of you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? And Gideon is speaking very kindly to them. He's saying, there's no reason for you to be envious. I've done nothing compared to you. What have I done now in comparison of you? You've actually done better than me. Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? He's basically saying, yes, Ephraim, you have come in, you have entered the scene a little late, just like those who glean fields. Gleaning of the grapes, that takes place after the harvest. So it's a bit late. It's after all the action has taken place, then somebody comes and gleans what is left. So Ephraim has done that. They've missed the initial battle, but Ephraim has come in late on the mopping up operation, and that has been more glorious than what they did. Yes, they won the initial victory, the Abiezrites and Gideon's clan, but Ephraim, they've come in, they've done a tremendous job. They've taken two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb. Gideon didn't take any princes, and so he's pointing this out to them. You have no reason to be envious. You have no reason to be angry. You have done well. You have served well. You have plenty to your credit, plenty to commend you. You have done well. And so this is the wisdom of Gideon. He abated their anger. God hath delivered into your hands, verse 3, the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, and what was I able to do in comparison of you? Then their anger was abated toward him when he had said that Gideon was so wise. And many attach those words that we find in Proverbs chapter 15, verse 1, to this incident regarding Gideon. A soft answer turneth away wrath. A soft answer. Ephraim is wroth with Gideon, but Gideon, how is he going to respond? He's not going to get angry at them. He's not going to fight fire with fire. He's going to say a soft word. He's going to assure them, comfort them. You've done a good work. You have done that which is commendable. He is keeping the peace. And this is a great sign of Gideon's worthiness and a great sign of his godliness. He keeps the peace. He doesn't argue with them. He doesn't fight with them. And again, this is an example for us. This is how Christians are to behave. If somebody comes to us with anger in their heart, even unnecessary and unjustifiable anger against us, how do we respond? Do we get angry back? That's not the Christian way. That's the way of the world, of course. We understand that. That's what the world teaches. If somebody gets angry with you, you get angry with them. If somebody punches you, you punch them. That's the way of the world. But the Christian way, well, he is faced, Gideon, with great anger, but a soft answer. He's totally disarmed the tribe of Ephraim. He's diffused the situation. He's a peacemaker. Blessed are the peacemakers, said the Lord Jesus Christ. Romans 14, verse 18, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. This is what Gideon is doing. He's not going to start an argument and fan the flames more than they already are fanned. He's going to bring peace to the situation. That's a great example to us. Without the church, within the church, if we are provoked, if somebody is acting angrily or unreasonably towards us, we don't escalate things. We seek peace. We seek to diffuse the argument and try to maintain peace, and much more can be resolved that way. That's what Gideon does. He shows great wisdom. He shows great humility. He is so humble. If Gideon had got angry, that would have shown that he was just as proud as Ephraim. How dare they criticize me? If he had got angry, it would have exposed his own pride. You shouldn't question me. But he shows instead his humility. He puts his pride to one side, and this was the right way. And by the way, he doesn't want anything to get in the way of the Lord's work. There is a battle still to be completed, a victory still to be won. And so he puts that ahead of all things. He lays aside all of his pride. I'm not going to get angry. There is work for the Lord to be done. That comes first. Not my own pride, not my own reputation. If Ephraim hates me, well, so be it. But I'm not going to do anything that gets in the way of the Lord's work. And so this is how Gideon handles this situation. And he continues in his work. And he has done so very wisely. So this is Gideon, and Gideon persevering. But then he has to deal not just with the anger of Ephraim, and he has dealt wonderfully with that, but then as the chapter unfolds, we see that he has to endure a double rejection, again by various tribes of Israel, or namely the tribe of Gad. So verse 4, Gideon came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him, faint, yet pursuing them. His men are faint, exhausted. And well, we could have added a point here about how we are to be spent for the Lord, exert ourselves as much as we possibly can. Yes, there is a time for rest, but the victory comes when we exert ourselves, when we even exhaust ourselves. There is no greater reason in the world to be exhausted than for the Lord's work. No greater reason. If we're going to be exhausted, let us be exhausted for the Lord's work, not for anything else. And so this was The case with Gideon and his men, they were exhausted, and yet they were winning. They were winning the battle. And that is how we proceed as the Lord's people. Then verse 5, they're weary, they're faint. And he said unto the men of Succoth, give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint. So he's asking the men of Succoth to give bread, to feed the army, because they are faint. And I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. And this is what Succoth reply in verse 6. And the princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thine army? So essentially, Gideon has asked the people of Succoth to feed his army. They've refused, or they are refusing. Why are they refusing? This is their reason. Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thine army? The reason they're refusing is they're saying, you haven't won the victory yet. You haven't won the victory, so we're a bit hesitant to give you any bread, any sustenance. We're not really sure that you can win this victory. You've only got 300 men, and the Midianites are so fierce and so strong. How can we know that you are going to win this victory? And in fact, we're too scared to give you bread because, well, they knew that if the Midianites won, well, then they would be in trouble because they had sided with Gideon and his men. And so they don't want to feed the army. They're just going to let them go hungry. And look at what Gideon says in verse 7. And Gideon said, therefore, when the Lord hath delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into mine hand, he's a man of faith, of course, remember, he knows that God will deliver the Midianites into his hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. And well, Gideon's response now is very stern. Why is Gideon stern here? He was very gentle with Ephraim, but now he is very stern. He's telling the men of Succoth, and he will also tell the men of Penuel, that there will be consequences for their actions. So what's the difference? Well, a number of differences. The primary one, of course, is that here, the princes of Succoth and the men of Penuel, there is a lack of faith. There is a real lack of faith, faithlessness. And faithlessness amongst the Lord's people, that does have to be dealt with. That can't be tolerated. Ephraim, yes, they were angry, they were petulant, but they weren't faithless. They were actually serving. They were actually fighting. But Succoth and Penuel, they're faithless. You can't win this battle. God isn't going to overcome the Midianites. The Midianites are too strong. We're too scared. We're too scared to give you bread. We're too scared to do anything out of faith. And that cannot be tolerated amongst the people of God. It cannot be tolerated, most certainly, in a church. This is a great crime. Remember, as we've been going through the gospel according to Mark, the strongest rebukes of the Lord Jesus Christ to his disciples are for their lack of faith. O ye of little faith. This is why Gideon is sterner, justifiably sterner with Succoth and Penuel, because of their lack of faith. And also, following on from that, well, the work is being hindered. Their battle is being hindered. And the army is not being fed. And well, of course, this goes without saying, nothing hinders the work of the Lord more than faithlessness. That's what really hinders the work of the Lord's people, faithlessness. This is why churches sometimes can be stunted, because there is so little faith, things they can't do. We can't start a Sunday school because of this reason. We can't go out and do evangelism because of that reason. Always some excuse, faithless excuse. The problem is they measure everything by sight. They don't walk by faith. They measure everything by sight, by the circumstances around them, earthly circumstances. And that is how they assess everything, just by what they see. This area is too hard. This church is too small. Yes, that's what they see. And they assess everything in the light of that. They walk by sight, when really what they should be doing is walking by faith and knowing that God can help them and knowing that God can do all things and God can confound all of their expectations completely. That's what it is to walk by faith, not simply looking at our circumstances. Succoth and Penuel, they looked at the circumstances. The Midianites are strong. The army is too small. The army is too weak, too faint. That's circumstances. They didn't look at the Lord, toward the Lord. They didn't consider him, what he can do. He can do all things, of course. We ought to believe this. We sing about this. And yet, so often, we do not put this into practice. And so this is why Gideon has these stern words. And then Penuel, verse 8, he went up thence to Penuel. Again, this is the tribe of Gad. And spake unto them likewise. He asked them for food. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. They gave the same excuse. And verse 9, he spake also unto the men of Penuel, saying, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. Well, we're not told entirely what kind of tower this was, but it was something that meant very much to the men of Penuel. Perhaps it was some kind of idolatrous altar. We're not told entirely, but there would be consequences for their faithlessness. But Gideon again, well, he perseveres. This is what we have to see. He's being discouraged. This is a series of discouragements by his own people. Ephraim having a go at him. And then Succoth and Penuel, again, Israelites not helping him. But he perseveres in the battle. And again, we take this to be a great lesson. We don't need everything to go our way and everything to be wonderful in our lives, even as Christian people, in order to serve the Lord. So often we make excuses. I would serve the Lord, but there's this thing going on in the church and somebody said this to me and I'm very discouraged. But look at the example of Gideon, persevering and continuing, even despite all the obstructions and the obstacles. And well, he continues with the Lord going before him. He wins this battle against Zeba and Zalmunna, the Midianite kings. Verse 10, now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their hosts with them, about 15,000 men, all that were left of all the hosts of the children of the east. For there fell 120,000 men that drew sword. This was how victorious and how successful Gideon and his men had been. 120,000 men, the Midianite army had been slain. And Gideon, verse 11, he goes up to the camp, which was secure, we read. But even though the camp of the Midianites is secure and well guarded, well, they win the battle. Verse 12, and when Zeba and Zalmunna fled, they are fleeing, he pursued after them and took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and discomfited all the host. He defeated them. And Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle, and he goes back to Succoth. Verse 14, he caught a young man of the men of Succoth and inquired of him, and he described unto him the princes of Succoth and the elders thereof, even 70 men. Now, the punishment or the chastisement that Gideon is going to mete out to the men of Succoth is only going to be upon the elders. That is why he's asking about the identity of the elders. There are 77 elders and leaders of Succoth. They are the ones who will face this chastisement. In verse 15, and he came unto the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, with whom ye did upbraid me, saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thy men that are weary? Well, they had been so faithless. And so Gideon comes and shows them, this is Zeba and Zalmunna. You never thought that this would happen. Your faith failed you. You were faithless, but look at what the Lord has done. I'm bringing you the kings of Midian right into your presence. And again, well, this is something we can apply. Faithlessness always makes a fool out of us. Faithlessness always makes a fool out of us. When we distrust the Lord, when we say in our hearts, oh, that will never happen, God can never do this, I will never see this in my lifetime, or that will never happen. Faithless attitudes, they always make a fool out of us. And we are so often proved wrong by the Lord, brought into our very presence the things that we thought would never happen. That's how God works. And sometimes he does it several times so that we learn our lesson and understand. Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, if only they had just believed, wouldn't it have been easier? Wouldn't that have been the right thing, to just believe the Lord? But they will be chastised. Verse 16, he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. Well, again, we're not sure entirely what took place, but it doesn't seem to be as though he took their lives, but this was some kind of chastisement. He taught the men of Succoth. This was a lesson to them, a lesson because of their faithlessness. Dear friends, may we avoid those lessons of faithlessness in our own lives, because they can be painful. The Lord may have to chastise us if we have little faith. And Penuel also receives their chastisement, which seems to be more severe, because we read that in verse 17, Gideon has to slay. He slew the men of the city. Perhaps it's because he began to take down this tower of Penuel, which was so precious to the inhabitants. And Gideon had no choice then but to slay them. Perhaps they were idolaters as well as faithless. But these are the sad consequences of faithlessness. It can do so much harm. But let us come to this final part that I wanted to look at this evening, down to verse 21, or well, we begin from verse 18. Then said he unto Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings, what manner of men were they whom ye slew at Tabor? So the Midianite kings are being questioned by Gideon of some men whom they slew at Mount Tabor. And they answered, as thou art, so were they. Each one resembled the children of a king. And he said, they were my brethren, even the sons of my mother. As the Lord liveth, if ye had saved them alive, I would not slay you. Well, it appears that these Midianite kings, in their slaughter of the Israelites, and their oppression of the Israelites, and certainly in the ensuing battle, they have taken the lives of Gideon's brothers, the sons of his mother, his kin on his mother's side. And so for this, there will be consequences again. And verse 20, we have quite an intriguing verse. And he said unto Jether, his firstborn, Gideon's firstborn son, up and slay them. But the youth drew not his sword, for he feared, because he was yet a youth. So Gideon speaks to his son, his firstborn, "You slay these Midianite kings," but he cannot do it. He does not draw his sword because we read that he feared, because he was yet a youth. And well, again, the commentators have a lot to say about this particular verse. Why does Gideon do this? What is the meaning of this? Some say Gideon should not have instructed his firstborn son to slay the kings. And some even make the application or the illustration that this is what happens when we expect too much from young converts, from young Christians. And the lesson is you shouldn't expect too much. If you expect them to do things too fast and too soon, they will fail. And well, maybe that's one of the lessons. It's a good application, but Jephthah, his firstborn, could not do the task. Some say that Gideon was trying to humble his son. Some suggest that Jephthah, because he was the firstborn, was very proud and he thought he could do everything. And so Gideon is saying to him, if you think you can do everything, slay these kings. And he couldn't do it. It was for his humbling. So that's another interpretation that we could add. Others say, and this is more of an illustrative interpretation, this shows how young people, how the young, find it very hard to slay their enemies in the sense of spiritual enemies. The young people, young converts again, they struggle to put to death those temptations and those besetting sins. They find it very hard. And what they do and what they ought to do is to look to their elders, look to Gideon to show them how to do it. Because in the next verse, of course, it is actually Gideon who does it. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, "Rise thou and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength." And Gideon arose and slew Zeba and Zalmunna and took away the ornaments that were on their camels' necks. And so Gideon has to do it. So that's another interpretation. The young, well, they struggle to overcome sin and temptation. And it's up to the elders, it's up to those who are mature to show them how to slay those enemies, those spiritual enemies. So there are a number of interpretations that we can put upon this incident. But the kings are slain. And look at those words, "For as the man is, so is his strength." And Gideon, well, of course, he was a man of great strength. He persevered. This is my final word. This is the theme I've been trying to get through this message. He perseveres despite all the discouragements. And perseverance itself is an act of faith. To persevere, to continue in the Christian life, to continue in the joy of the Lord, despite all the discouragements and all the hindrances and all the frustrations, that is a great act of faith. That in itself requires faith. That in itself is a definition of walking by faith. And that is what we are to do. We're all going to know discouragements. We're all going to know those things that hold us back. But we must look to the Lord. Measure all things, remember, by faith, not by sight, not by our circumstances. Yes, we can assess certain things. We can plan ahead. We can use wisdom according to the things that we see in certain regards. But a great part of our wisdom, a great part of what it is to be wise as Christians, is to trust in the Lord and to know that we don't have any idea what is going to happen in the future. That's part of our wisdom. Understanding, acknowledging that we don't even know what is going to happen tomorrow. But we know that the Lord does. That's what it is to be wise, and we trust in him. And we know that he can do all things. So these are the lessons that we see here with Gideon. But next week, or rather in a couple of weeks' time, we will see Gideon make a mistake, and we will again have to learn from that incident. So may the Lord bless these things to us.